गुड आफ्टरनून, नमस्कार, सत श्री अकाल, वनकम टू वन एंड ऑल. आई वेलकम द एस्टीम्ड पैनलिस्ट्स एंड द व्यूअर्स हु हैव जॉइंड फॉर द वेबिनार ऑन दिस इम्पोर्टेंट टॉपिक. वी हैव अ वेरी डिस्टिंग्विश्ड पैनल फ्रॉम डिफरेंट वॉक्स ऑफ लाइफ, पॉलिटिशियंस, एक्स चीफ इलेक्शन कमिश्नर ऑफ द इलेक्शन कमीशन ऑफ इंडिया, एडवोकेट्स एंड रिप्रेजेंटेटिव फ्रॉम द सिविल सोसाइटी. This event is an opportunity for us to add impetus and synergy to our work by bringing together all stakeholders. Since some people have asked why there is no representative from the ruling party, I would like to place on record that we had contacted 4 persons from the BJP, out of which 3 declined and 1 did not respond at all. Since this is an important subject which affects all political parties and the citizens of the country, it would have been nice if they had also participated, but they must be having certain reasons. Just to refresh the minds of the panelists and their viewers, I will once again share the focus points of the webinar with a request that the panelists give their views on the points specifically. Nandini, can you please show that? So the first focus point is curbing the rising number of legislators with criminal cases. Who will bell the cat? Executive or the judiciary? Does repeated election of tainted politicians adversely affect good governance? Is the Indian voter unaffected by the tainted background of politicians? Lifetime ban or disqualification for 10 to 15 years for convicted politicians, which is appropriate? Slew of Supreme Court judgments such as fast track courts, trials to be completed within a year, publication of criminal cases details by candidates and political parties in the media, etc., as also the recommendations of various committees, commissions, etc., have been unable to bring about reform. Is there a way forward, or will the voters or citizens remain captive of the current duplicitous system wherein the rules of the game are different for the politicians and the common citizens? To set the context, I will show you a few slides so that we are all aware of the present state of MPs and MLAs with criminal cases and how the numbers are steadily rising over the years. Nandini, can you please show the slides? So as you see this one, this gives the details of the candidates from the Lok Sabha of 2004 right up till the latest Lok Sabha. And if you see in 2004, the figure or the percentage of candidates with criminal cases was 12% and with serious criminal cases was 7%. In 2009, it rose to 15% and 8% serious criminal cases. In 14, it rose to 17% with declared criminal cases and 11% with serious criminal cases. In 2019, it rose to 19% and 13% candidates with serious criminal cases. And in 2024, it has risen to 20% and 14% candidates with serious criminal cases. The same thing is also represented in the bar chart in the lower part of the slide. Next, please. If we were to talk about the party-wise percentage of candidates with declared criminal cases, I have just taken some of the important parties because the national parties, as you are aware, kept changing. Like Aam Aadmi Party wasn't there at all and TMC was removed. So I just taken this as a sample. So if you see for Congress, it has risen from 2009, where it was 27% to 44% in 2024. For BJP, it has risen from 27% to 43% in 2024. For BSP or BASPA, from 22% it has come down to 13%. And for CPIM, from 25% In 2009, it has risen to 63%. And the slide, which is on the lower half, it gives the details of the MPs with declared criminal cases from the general elections 2004 to 2024. So in 2004, the percentage of MPs with criminal cases was 24%, and with serious criminal cases was 11%. In 2009, it rose to 30% and 14%. In 2014, it rose to 34% and 21%. And in 2019, it rose to 43% and 29% with serious criminal cases. And in 24, the present lot, it is 46% with criminal cases and 31% with serious criminal cases. Okay, next please. So this is the same thing represented in a bar chart. We can go to the next slide, please.
Jonathan, I can't see the PPT. Just for your information, otherwise you carry on. If you can settle it, it will be good. Otherwise,
okay. Nandini, can you just see what is... I hope the others are able to see it.
Yes, we can see it, I guess.
Okay. All right. Okay. Next slide, please. Neha. We recently, just about a week back, published the report of analysis of all the MLAs from 28 states and 3 union territories of India. So the total MLAs were analyzed was 4,092 out of 4,123. 45% had criminal cases, and 29% MLAs had serious criminal cases. Next slide, please. Party-wise percentage. Again, I have taken a few of the major parties. So if you see, TDP, 86% means MLAs with criminal cases, and 61 means percentage of MLAs with serious criminal cases. So the left one is, the left bar chart is serious criminal cases, and the right one is serious criminal case. In case of DMK, it is 74% and 32%. In case of SP, SAPA, 62% and 44%. And Aam Aadmi Party, 56% and 28%. Congress, 52% and 30%. And AIPC, Trinamool, 41% and 34%. And BJP is 39% with criminal cases and 26% with serious criminal cases. Now, since BJP has the largest number of MLAs, then total number of MLAs analyzed is 1653, which is more than the number of MLAs of all the other parties shown in this chart combined together. Now, having seen this, now let me get down to the thing. I will request all panelists to kindly restrict their views to about 12 minutes or so. And in the end, we'll have a question and answer session. Viewers are requested to post their questions on chat, and questions will be displayed by our team on the ticker tape. Since the parliament session is going on, we are thankful to Sri Gogoi for having spared the time and squeezed out a little time to be part of this webinar and share his view. Since he has to leave early, I will introduce him to the audience before I request him to speak. As you all know, Sri Gaurav Gogoi is a member of the parliament and deputy leader of the Indian National Congress in Lok Sabha. He is member of the parliament representing the Kaliabore constituency of Assam. And prior to joining politics, he worked in the development and non-profit space for 10 years. After graduating from Indraprastha University in engineering, he worked in a non-profit organization which sought to impact social justice through youth citizenship action. After 4 years of working in rural India, he went to pursue master's in public administration at New York University. And during his stint in the US, he worked as a policy aide at the permanent mission of India to the United States. As I mentioned, Mr. Gogoi, if you have time, we will ask the audience to put their questions to you before you leave, if that is fine with you. And I'll request you to now kindly share your views. Thank you.
Thank you, Major Verma, and thank you to the Association of Democratic Reforms for having me here. I again apologize that I have to leave soon, because as you said, the parliament is in session, there are committee meetings, but this is a subject that I've engaged with at many times in the past, and therefore I wanted to be part of this webinar, both to share my experiences as someone who is been thinking on this issue, but is also is one of the stakeholders, which is the political party in my particular case. So I really was interested to take part in this seminar and therefore hear from other stakeholders, whether it's public, civil society, election commission, or the judiciary. My view when I first was engaging with this subject, when I was in the civil society, was that there should be, this is a very serious issue, which is that the number of people with criminal records and severe criminal cases who are joining the field of politics and are contesting elections and are winning elections is a very serious issue. And there are many issues related to electoral reform, especially in India. Within all the issues that come under electoral reform, this is one of those sub-issues which are very important. That is something that I always felt. But then as I engaged in politics, got more active in politics, saw, you know, what do people keep in mind when voting? It is unfortunate that I realize that people are not keeping in mind, the voter in India is not keeping in mind the criminal antecedents of a person while voting. Now, this is not a judgment call, and I'm not making an opinion, but I'm just stating my experiences, albeit it is anecdotal experiences. But largely, even though when you mentioned that the number of people with criminal cases are rising and every political party has these candidates, I think if you analyze the winnability or how many times have they won, in many cases, it might seem that they are winning. So it is not the criminal cases and the criminal past right now is not a deterrent in the voter's mind. And I think that is something that we have to engage with voters, for which one of the first things we have to do, which is to raise awareness, which is to make the information that you have shared in your slide that much more publicly available. You know, people have the right to know the background of their candidates, and they have the right to know, they have the right that this information should be accessible. It should, you know, it should not just be on a website. The citizens should be able to access this information much more easily, you know, at the click of their finger or the tap of the finger. Many of this information is already there in the election affidavit that is filed by the candidates. But I'm not sure if the voter in my constituency is able to access my affidavit and is able to go through those sections very easily in a user-friendly format. You know, in that affidavit, as a candidate who just contested Lok Sabha, you know, I file in the details of my income, I file the details of my any cases that might be against me. I file my social media properties. I file details related to my educational and professional background. So all of this information I'm filing legally. But does my voter, is he aware? Can they access it? Because the only time this information becomes public is when the media chooses to write about it. That's the only time we know how much wealth a candidate has or how much wealth of, you know, has a candidate managed to enhanced over the last 5-6 years, or what are their professional background, or what are criminal cases. That media story, if it gets published, is right now one way that the information reaches the voter. So I think that's something that we need to think about. And, you know, political parties respond to public pressure. If the public in Delhi today are pressurizing on air pollution, then the political parties, be it opposition or ruling, they will respond to that pressure. It's a pull. You have to pull the attention of the political class. And you have to put that pressure that, listen, this is a serious issue. You know, say safety of women in public spaces is a serious issue. Air pollution is a serious issue. Education, sewage, drainage is a serious issue. And amongst the plethora of issues that exist, along with unemployment and inflation, so is the issue of criminal people of with criminal cases entering politics. So I think the therefore, how do you mobilize the public? A, to create awareness, to increase their awareness. B, to channelize their energies, to put pressure, to signal to political parties that we will punish through our vote if we find that you're indulging in such candidates. And we will reward you. We will reward you if you choose a cleaner candidate or a candidate with no criminal cases. So, you know, I in my own experience, I know of a state in North India where one of the candidates had a criminal case because that candidate had physically beaten up and assaulted a government officer. Now, at that time, even though there was no public pressure on the political party to change the candidate, it was in that particular case of which I'm aware of, it was the call of the political leadership. The political leadership at that point said, listen, even though there is no public pressure, we feel that we should not have such a person on our ticket representing our symbol. And then they took a call at a high level meeting that we will deny the opportunity to this person to contest. But all of that decision making was in-house. It was at the very top level, at a very senior level, but it was done very quietly. It was done very discreetly. So the other case, when I'm saying where we can engage with this issue, is at the issue of political leadership. And we tell them that, you know, this is something that is important. This was something that will show you in a good stead. Now, there are the pressure that we have these days on representation is on more women. We're talking about more women representatives coming in the Vidhan Sabha and the and on the Lok Sabha. So, but many parties, they themselves, before the Women's Reservation Bill had come, many parties, they themselves, because of the philosophy of their political leadership, said that, you know, we want to promote more women, we want to promote more youth, and therefore we have to, that's a decision that we will take. So here, you know, there was no role of the Election Commission, no role of a law passed by Parliament, no role of the public, but political leadership, they themselves decided this. So, you know, these are two aspects that I wanted to place in my opening statement. One, that of that our public punishing or rewarding basis the criminal antecedents of a candidate. B, you know, our political leadership, how can they be more sensitized to think on this issue, and what positive reinforcement can be given for behavior or for decisions that we like. Other than that, you know, if I just carefully, if I, you know, from a more academic point of view, you know, if the public has the right to choose whoever they want as their representative, then can we deny an Indian citizen the right to contest? If the most purely as an academic discussion, you know, if an Indian convict has the right to appeal to the final stage, he doesn't lose the right to appeal. He doesn't lose the right, he or she doesn't lose the right to legal representation. Then an Indian citizen, on the basis of his conviction, should he lose the right to be a public representative? you know, it's an academic question that we can think about, because I'm not aware of any major democracy in major in terms of its size and its scale having any legislation around lifetime bans. In fact, I know the opposite, that many people, like in India, in other major democracies also, people have served time in jail and they have been severely convicted, and yet they go on to take part. That doesn't bar them from taking part in the electoral process. So nonetheless, it's, you know, for India, I think this is a very important subject that we should continue to engage on. We should continue to push the boundaries, find ways of making it, of raising the bar for the kind of people that get into electoral politics, reward decisions of political parties that are akin to what we are talking about. At the same time, raise public awareness, make this information, you know, ADR is doing brilliant work, but have other, you know, the statewide chapters or vernacular versions of ADR doing this work much more proactively, and allowing the citizenry also to engage this issue and voice their concerns in a much more organized manner. So with that, I'll just thought I'd lay out, you know, what my position on this topic currently is. And thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Gogoi, for your views. I just have a comment. It appears that, you know, specifically you have answered some of the questions which the focus points were made out for. But you haven't answered the thing about, you know, there have been so many Supreme Court judgments. And the first question is, who will bail the cat, executive or judiciary? I specifically didn't mention political parties because the political parties do not want to do it. So you have sort of put the onus on the citizens and the voters to do it. And you also mentioned that criminality somehow doesn't form a very important part in the decision of a voter. So is it going to continue like this? And is it, and the answer, and this question about, does this affect good governance? If you could kindly answer. Thank you.
No, I did not only restrict it to citizens' engagement. I did talk about political leadership, that political parties have a role to play in this. I did give an example of which I was part of, in which my political party denied a ticket to a person merely, you know, say, because of his criminal record, despite there being adverse remarks in public. But the political leadership at that time, in that case, did take its call. So I do place the emphasis on political parties themselves. But if I were to crystal gaze in this particular context, I could, you know, look at a foreseeable scenario in which the judiciary calls upon the election commission to think on this issue, and therefore election commission, in response to a Supreme Court request, thinks deeply and comes up with language that can be taken as a reform. Thank you. I think you're on mute.
I would just like to respond as far as what ADR is doing. Like you mentioned correctly, that the voter needs to be more informed and he can take a choice after, you know, seeing the details of the candidates. We are doing our best. We put out these reports. And by the way, most of 95% of the media reports are based on ADR reports only, wherein we give out all these details. As also, myneta.info is a very popular site and lakhs of people see it during elections, before elections. And the third thing is, we also have an app, MyNeta app, on which at the click of this thing, you can see all the details. So we do publicize all this, and we are very, you know, on the social media, we do all this. And of course, with limited resources and all, we have a limited reach, but we are trying our best. So, Nandini, there's one question, I think, for Mr. Gaurav before we let him go. Yeah. So this is the question from Afreen Siddiqui Sherwani. She is from UNDP. Her question is, being from the development sector and being deputy leader of the INC, what are some of the ideas you can or want to introduce just as a party level, not waiting for judicial reforms morally, voluntarily?
Thank you, Afreen. I think, first of all, as I said, that I look at this issue under the broader ambit of electoral reform. I think there are many questions that we have to address with respect to elections and the way they are conducted. So not only the way candidates are able to contest election, but also other aspects which are in public domain. So as a member of a political party, I would like to have a discussion, an all-party discussion on electoral reform inside public, under the rules that is available to us in Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha, and let the public see that, you know, what ideas are different parties talking about when it comes to electoral reform, and specifically when it comes to the criminal background of a candidate. Secondly, you know, as I said, in this particular case of which I was a part of, I did support the decision of my political leadership that, you know, when we, from a political analyst point of view, the candidate that we chose not to give the ticket to was, in terms of winnability and other aspects, had a very strong, favorable rating amongst the public. Was very popular amongst his supporters and amongst the general public. But on the basis of this, you know, we decided to not give him the ticket, and that's a decision I supported. And I think, again, within our party also, you know, when these conversations are had, usually at the time of election, because that's the time when we are looking at the background of candidates, I think, you know, having been part of many screening committees, I'll continue to, you know, bring this information to public, or sorry, not to public, but bring this, in, make this information more transparent. So the criminal background should not be hidden or should not be diluted while we are discussing in a party platform. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question, Janata?
Please, sir, go ahead, sir.
Yeah. Mr. Gogoi, you mentioned that one person was denied ticket because of his criminal background. Very good news. But I'm very curious to know what happened to the person you gave ticket to. Did he win or did you lose that seat?
As I told you, Qureshi ji, the person that we denied had very high approval rating amongst the voters, amongst the public, amongst his supporters. And we knew that we will put forward as an alternative someone with lower ratings, but we took that call and we lost the seat.
We lost the seat, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Would you take one more question, Mr. Gogoi, before you leave?
Yeah, maybe one last and then I'll
leave. Yeah, to leave. Okay, Nandi, just one more question. This is from Mr. Dhruv Sen. Is this issue discussed in Parliament? If not, would you, Mr. Gogoi, like to initiate discussion in Lok Sabha?
No, I don't want to take any personal credit on this matter. I think all political parties are discussing electoral reform. I think, you know, institutions such as ADR are talking about electoral reform. Former election commissioners are commenting on this, writing about it. So, you know, we're having this debate everywhere but inside Parliament where it matters. I think we're having this debate inside political parties in our back rooms also when we discuss tickets. So definitely, I think this issue needs to be put forward in Parliament, as I said, under the broader ambit of electoral reform. It is, again, I must say, you know, I myself used, I'm aware of ADR's work. We We just last week referred to ADR's report on how many MLAs in Assam have cases related to harassment and molestation of women. So we did refer to the case, but I think, you know, for a country, even for my Lok Sabha constituency of 18 to 19 lakhs, we don't need one ADR, we need many ADRs, and we need ADRs in many languages and in many formats. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gogoi. Thank you very much. And if the, any of the panelists wants to ask him something, because it's 3:30, he has to leave. Okay, Mr. Gogoi, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
And very nice of you to have spared the time and given your views. Thank you very much. I will now request Ms. Kavita Srivastav. She is the president of People's Union for Civil Liberties. She is a full-time human rights activist working to protect people's democratic and constitutional rights and to work towards justice in instances of violence, violation of people's rights. Since 1994, Kavita has been promoting the formation of citizens' collectives to protect the civil liberties and democratic rights of every citizen. For two decades, she has been promoting collectively with other social groups non-violent ways of ensuring justice to survivors of atrocities committed due to gender, class, caste, religious group, or nationality. Her accomplishments include work with the women's movement in Rajasthan, which has initiated laws against widow burning and national guidelines against violence against women. Kavita ji, all yours.
Thank you so much, ADR, for inviting me. And thank you for posing these questions to a human rights organization and also one of the petitioners of the Right to Know, which came in 2003 with every voter having the right to have the right to know what is the candidate's education levels, what is the candidate's wealth status, movable, immovable property, wife, family, etc., and also regarding criminality. However, there's been a dilemma right from the beginning regarding all these three. For instance, even at that point of time, we had said that it's more important to know the education of the parents of the candidate, because education has taken years and years to reach people. And, it's even today, the number of Adivasi women or Adivasi men who are accessing education is still remains small, very small. So at that point of time, we had said that it's very important, you know, this should be added in the form. Secondly, regarding criminality, even then there was a dilemma regarding, the system. What about dissenters? What about criminalization of dissent? And even at that point of time, we had said that how will the public distinguish between a case that is being put against you because you're a dissenter, and how will they realize that this is, can we actually discuss that this is a different case and this is a different case? So while you need to give some sort of leeway to this political opposition person, his case may be a false case. And so even at that point of time, we had questions regarding this, and it was debated amongst us. And I think later, I think the question whether at the charge sheet stage itself we need to disqualify people, that matter went up, I think, to a constitutional bench. And the constitutional bench did not say that don't do it, said you could consider, and it remains there itself. However, our position in the PUCL has changed. Let me not say PUCL. A section of our organization would like to have some sort of, we want this collective and particularly ADR. And let me tell you why ADR is very, very important for us, because we use all your reports. We don't have to do that work. You know, we are all volunteers of the human rights movement. So we don't have staff. We don't have to go through those affidavits. Earlier, we used to go through those. I remember preparing precisely on various criminality and others, some analysis. But now we get, because of you, and it's so good, right at the onset, you know, of the campaign, we do this press conference with you. I mean, all that is really, really good. And we use all your documents and go to the people, because ours is also going back to the people, going back. We are not a political party. We are a minuscule. We are not a mass organization. We're a very, very small organization, but we do go to the people. So it also becomes very important, the documents you give us. However, there is this question that we now need to ask. And since we have people like Mr. Qureshi, and we have all of you who've been thinking, and parties representative who think day and night on this issue much more than us, is the weaponization of the criminal justice system against the not just the political opposition, but and not just dissenters, but all those who question. There is a weaponization of the criminal justice system. You know, whether an FIR will be lodged or not lodged, whether a charge sheet will happen or not happen, and whether, you know, the pace at which a trial will move, even that is extremely determined. Because the police was always subservient. I mean, we had Prakash Singh Badal case where they wanted to liberate the police of the political system. It never happened. We had Prashant is one of our speakers. He was also a petitioner and intervener in it. There have been 8-9 reports. So the police was never independent. However, we still felt that, you know, there was justice happening. I mean, I have worked with the criminal justice system for the last 30 years consistently. And I would still go with a lot of hope that something will happen. I mean, I wouldn't say the whole system in Rajasthan, at least, which is my karam bhumi, is totally vitiated. No, we used to get a lot of work done. We also thought that the administration would do fair inquiries or whatever. And the judiciary, we thought, yeah, maybe a third of our cases just get... there's a travesty of justice. I mean, we have all witnessed Bhavri Devi and all that. But today, I am really not sure with the way the whole judiciary is also being weaponized against activists. And the police has become even more subservient. And the kind of campaign-led criminality that is determined by, you know, the media and social media campaigns against people. Can we just say that he is a prisoner of conscience, so you should vote him? She was a dissenter, so she had a case. I think it's getting more and more difficult. Even if, am I there? Am I audible?
Yes, we
Major
can hear
General
you.
Barma?
Yes.
So with a fair system, I mean, the kind of proposals you have brought up, like say, let's take the proposal of tainted. I think we all know the case against, I mean, I know Dr. Binayak Sen, the first case as dissenter, as PUCL vice president, he was booked. I know he is completely innocent, but there has been a conviction, you know, life sentence for sedition. Similarly, Umar Khalid, there's been 55 cases of murder of 55 people, 55 attempt to murder of 150 people. We know it's all rubbish. We know it, that the whole case is abdicated. However, will the taint ever come out? The taint remains in some, and the taint does not. We campaigned against Brij Bhushan Singh or Attaney, you know, just in the last elections. So Brij Bhushan Singh, because there was so much of public outcry, they didn't give him. They gave his son. But he won the election. Everybody knows who won the election. So I feel, and I'm not just one, I'm only, in order to highlight my case, I'm stating this, but the way minorities, particularly Muslims, are being criminalized, Adivasis, because it's become tooth and nail to protect your resources, and we are seeing a war at one level. So it's in this context that we have to look at criminality, which I mean, all of us work towards bringing wanting the public to know that, you know, look at this. This is the crime that the person has committed. So as far as we are concerned, there are two things. One is that disclosure has to be absolute. You have to disclose. It's very good that we have it. But I don't think at this stage we can agree that ban the person 10 years, 15 years. I don't think we can. That will really, really be... I mean, George Fernandez was in jail and he fights and wins and so many. I mean, look at Omar Rashid from Kashmir. And look at the other side, Rahul Gandhi. I wonder, I mean, I didn't hear the whole of Mr. Gogoi because there was a situation where I had to be in the first few minutes. I mean, Rahul Gandhi is convicted for a minor case in little time, even before he can appeal. The parliament procedure revoking his membership and getting him to empty out his house also. It moved like this. Again, you will say, well, there will be exceptions, you know, there will be some. But I think it's very important to understand how this system can be weaponized. I mean, what about Kejriwal? They came totally on an anti-corruption movement. And finally, Kejriwal goes to case on precisely, I mean, so some will go in corruption, some will go in sedition, somebody like Harshwandar. Every agency, I'm not saying he's going to fight elections, but they could use every agency against him, whether it's CBI, whether it's ED, whether it's IT. And finally, what they're going to do with it, we don't know. But definitely it won't be UAPA, we're very clear, or sedition, it's going to be corruption. You know, so... I feel we have to pause, Major General Verma. I think you people have to continuously ask us these questions. We cannot leave it hanging. It has to be there. And secondly, this question of yours, this question that you've posed to all of us, it's a public question now. I've already sort of posted these questions to everybody in PUCL, including Mr. Sanjay Parekh, who was the lawyer then with Justice Sachin. I said, answer this and give. The other question is that we as an organization have to take all of this to the people. And I think I just heard you say that what is the onus on the judiciary, on the executive? But when the judiciary and the executive doesn't listen to you, when the judiciary and executive is itself, I mean, we've seen bulldozer justice in a particular way. This is our context. And the judiciary never heard it. 5 years or 7 years later, they've taken cognizance. I think we need to take, like your reports, in a small way, we make parchas and take to the people. We have to take all these questions also to the people. I think you have posed these questions to the people of India. Tell us, are we going to continue with this? The criminal rule, the lawbreaker being the lawmaker. Now, who's the lawbreaker? That is the uljhan I have. That's my dilemma, you know. So I would try to conclude by saying that what you have initiated is a debate. You and I cannot, I mean, maybe you can answer. You all are into it on a daily basis. But I or our organization, look at the larger context of human rights in order to understand our, defining and something especially like criminality. Like we always say in the civil liberties movement, that civil liberties is the bedrock of democracy. Secularism is the bedrock of democracy. Similarly, I think this push for honest legislators, this push for, you know, we don't want bullies. We don't want murderers. But again, I'm talking with a certain question mark. Some of our friends there were false cases. So I end here by saying that these are larger questions that we have to pose to the public. You have initiated it in a small way. It should go into the parliament. It should go into all platforms which where democratic rights are being discussed. I mean, look at the hate speech. So again, so I conclude by saying that will we give more power to the state? It's the state power which is something that we are critical of. Will we give more power to the state to disqualify? I'm not even talking about the CEC, because at this point of time, CEC is merged in a way with the executive. CEC is not independent. That's something that we need to wrest CEC out of it. That should be a simultaneous kind of job that we need to do.
So I
made my points.
So you're muted.
Yeah, I have muted myself. Am I audible now? Okay. Yes. Thank you, Kavita, for your views. Very clear. But the dilemma still remains. If the judiciary is not going to do anything, if the executive is not going to do anything, and if the onus is entirely on the civil society organization, then we will never succeed, because for the simple reason, the public, the common people, as the politicians have said, they don't take criminality seriously. So where are we? Are we going to continue like this? And the question remains, one of the focus points, does this affect good governance?
It does. It absolutely does. I mean, I think corruption is a very, very good issue, but a very big issue. But the onus is on the public, in the public. We have to make the government accountable. We cannot keep adding more power to the state. We have to make state accountable. And that only the public can do. Parliament as an institution is almost over. And all this. So the public has a major role at this crossroads. The civil society brought these laws and gave it to the public. And we moved quite a bit. But at that point, the context was slightly different. In today's context, the public really has to decide. I'm not saying civil society. Our role is to take these questions. Our role is to bring clarity. Our role is to understand how it happened globally and share. You know, there's a major role. But at the end of the day, the Indian public has to decide. Otherwise, it's not much that we can do.
Okay, thank you. Nandini, do we have any questions for Kavita? We can take one before she leaves. Yeah, again, this is from Afreen. What are some of the countries you would like India to learn from, human rights side of governance? What are some of the countries you would like India to learn from, human rights side of governance?
So I think Scandinavian countries have had accountability systems. I think basically all those countries where you can make, ours is a colonial legacy, so we don't have accountability systems where we can make the state accountable. Like say, for instance, RTI was a law which empowered the people against the state, and now that also we are losing. So all those countries, and I think some of the best examples are the Scandinavian countries. I remember going to Brazil just for this, looking at their governance on food issues. That is about a decade ago. And some very, very good systems they had put in place as far as people's accountability was concerned. Not just the kind of policies and plans they had, but they had the kind of accountability that was worked towards. So in some element, I mean, I won't say every country is the best, but some systems in some countries, we need to learn from South Africa also, we need to learn. So these are some of the things, but in our country, I feel, we did learn, from other countries. We need to say, for instance, bring in the accountability law, something that the Rajasthan civil society groups have been, for the last 10 years, we have been taking this, that this is part two of RTI. We need the accountability law for all platforms of governance. And it's only accountability, those governance systems, we need to bring in. It's not just that you have a model citizen, you know. Our people are not even enabled to become citizens. When women have agency and they start taking decisions, the state, say for instance, the right to choice, and she's expressing her autonomy through her citizenship and wants to marry somebody of her choice. We know how heavily the police and the executive comes in to assist the family to prevent all that. We keep hearing about it every day. So it's also a struggle to become citizen. So that kind of governance in which I get these platforms to ask questions, to make accountable, those are some of the questions that we have to ask. There is no shortcut, Major General Verma. This criminality cannot be done through laws. We have to work very hard with the people. That's something that I'd like to say. And we have done it. I mean, it's not that we've not done it.
Thank you, Gautaji. Thank you so much. She's involved in some very important issue. She's sitting with some lawyers to sort that out. So she has also requested to be relieved now. Gautaji, thank you very much for your views.
Thank you, and we are your partners in this. Please take us along with you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Qureshi. I'm sorry. I'll hear you on YouTube and other speakers.
Thank you very much. Thank you.